is RSL Boys Are Cold, and you're listening to Monday Night Blah. What is it?
Monday Night Talk.
Oh.
On WATD.
In WATD.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. We thank the Senator for joining us for a few moments, and we move forward. We have a very special guest joining us in studio. He is an author of a book called Animal, the Bloody Rise and Fall of the Mob's Most Feared Assassin. And we actually brought in some special help from the newsroom, as we have Christine James is going to join us in talking about Casey Sherman's book. You're a well-known, not only as a guy who writes books, but you also have a little bit of a time in the news field as well, don't you?
Sure. Well, this is my sixth book. I was spent 20 years in the news field as a producer for CBS. Mm-hmm. During that time, I guess my name really came to prominence for the first time from my reinvestigation of the Boston Strangler case, and that was because my aunt was 19-year-old Mary Sullivan, the youngest and final victim of that case. I reinvestigated that case for 15 years, proved that history got the wrong man, and then I call myself the accidental author because I was never going to write a book about the case, but several high-profile writers like Sebastian Younger, for example, they all got in touch with me, and they said, you know, this story is fascinating, and we want to write your book. And I first thought, well, geez, that's flattering. And then I said, wait a minute, I'm a journalist. I live this case. If anybody's going to write it, it's going to be me. Mm. And it's going to succeed or fail on those merits. And fortunately, that book became a surprise bestseller. And then out came five more.
I have to ask you, it is, you know, after the first book, do you kind of get yourself into a mode, you kind of a system and able to put, or has each book been different?
Oh, each book has been totally different. I never want to repeat myself. I don't want to be caught, you know.
No redundancy.
No redundancy. And, you know, that's for my own personal taste. I always want to explore a story that I haven't even thought of in the past. I've written about Coast Guard rescues off Cape Cod in a book called The Finest Hours, which Disney is now producing into a film. I wrote about a showdown on a dusty road in Franconia, New Hampshire, where two men ended up dead, called Bad Blood, completely different from a serial killer book. And then this book about the mob that I wrote, you know, I'd been asked to write a book about Whitey Bulger because I'd covered the Whitey Bulger case. I'd met Whitey Bulger. I'd lived in South Boston for a long time during the 90s at his reign. And I thought, you know what? Everybody's written about Whitey Bulger. There's just no more information out there that I could really bring to the forefront. What I wanted to do is I wanted to tell the origin story about how the FBI became involved with some of these gangsters in Boston, and I found the story about Joe the Animal Barboza and went from there.
And, you know, when I saw that you had written this book, Casey, I definitely wanted to talk with you. I met you years ago when you were still working for CBS. I met you through Bob Stone, and you had just written A Rose for Mary. And it was great because you brought in the lead investigator with you, and we did an interview here. And I liked the way you cut through all the nonsense. You didn't say, okay, here's something that if you Google it, you go through the information, this is what happened, X, Y, Z. You just said, no, I'm starting from the beginning. I'm going to go through here. This is wrong. This is wrong. Here's the proof, X, Y, Z. I thought, this guy really knows what he's doing, and you're a good writer.
Well, you know, you start out in any investigation, you don't want to have the conclusion in your head already. You know, the evidence and the information really has to take you to where you want to go. And there are many times that I've started to write a book that just has not had enough elements really to sustain a narrative over 200 some odd pages. But with the Barboza story, I looked at it a little differently than some of the other mob books out there. Joe Barboza was from New Bedford, Massachusetts, Portuguese by heritage. And his goal in life, his mission, was to become a member of La Cosa Nostra. And, you know, being a Sicilian society, they were not going to let Joe Barboza in.
Right.
But he thought, well, if I'm just the best employee they have, if I just kill more people than anybody else, they're going to have to let me in. And I really looked at it as like a class story. I remember those old stories about Joe Kennedy being so upset as a Harvard student for not being allowed into some of these Protestant clubs. And that was the kind of the prism for which I told Joe Barboza's story. And it's, know, it's he becomes a vulnerable character. He's a psychotic killer, obviously, but he's also a man with a wife and two children, and the mob's gunning for him, and he's got no choice but to turn against them.
So Joseph the animal, Barboza, one of the first nicknames I ever remember reading about. Mm. Why did they call him an animal? Why were they afraid of him? I mean, he looks like a pretty tough guy.
Well, that's the one thing. You know, when somebody like that can strike fear in the heart of the mafia, he got his nickname, and this has been embellished over time, and I put it in the book, but I let the reader really
just... grown?
Yes, exactly. Nobody who had been in that bar at that night is around to tell that story today firsthand, but apparently he bit the cheek of a made mafia member off and spit it on the bar. And that's really how I open the book. And they called him the animal to his face, but they called him a lot of other really bad words behind his back. For the mafia, Joe Barboza was the tip of the spear. He was a weapon to be used, but eventually discarded, and that's what they tried to do.
It seems to me as though they used him until they felt they couldn't use him anymore. And they basically tried to get him, they got him incarcerated, did they not?
Well, that's right. I mean, you can do two things to an animal when it gets out of control. You can kill it, or you can cage it. And they first chose to set him up for a crime that he didn't commit on a weapons charge. There were some cops that the mafia paid off to put some weapons in his car, kept Joe behind bars for several weeks, and usually at that time Raymond Patriarch or somebody within the organization would send money to bail all these guys out. Now, when this was all happening, it was the early 1960s, you had a mob war in Boston where 57 men were murdered in a 3.5 year span. Now, that's the bloodiest mob war in American history. That never happened in Capone, Chicago. That never happened in New York City. That never happened with Nicky Scarfo in Philadelphia. That happened in Boston. And Joe Barboza was the lead trigger man in most of those murders.
When you set out to do research on books like this, and you're looking for original sources and stuff that took place in the 60s, How did you find this? I mean, don't give away all your secrets, but did you find some old mobsters that were willing to talk?
Oh, sure. I mean, which is a little different from the Boston Strangler book that I wrote, where a lot of those people were still around and threatening me on a, you know, regular basis, saying, we know what route you take to work every day, stay away from this case. The Barboza story was a little different. A lot of these guys are very well along in age. They wanted to tell their story. And just to show you how significant the Barboza story is in the lore, you know, in the annals of organized crime in America, Joe Barboza was the first man, first gangster to ever testify against the mafia in a criminal trial, and he did it 3 times. He was the first man to ever be placed in the witness protection program. In fact, they created it for him early on when he was testifying against Raymond Patriarca and Jerry Angiulo in Boston. They actually hid Barboza on an island in Boston Harbor called Thatcher Island. It's right off Rockport. Hit him there with his family, his wife, and his child. And while the mafia, while Patriarca, is paying hitmen to rent speedboats in hopes of killing Barboza. It's a fascinating story. And, you know, Martin Scorsese couldn't make up half the things that are in this book for real.
See, my curious question here is anytime you see a mob movie, somewhere the FBI is lurking, and this is quite the same. You have the FBI got in here, and if anything, attempted to use the animal against the mafia and was successful, I guess, in a couple of different cases, correct?
Yeah, exactly. And it goes all the way back even further to there was an agreement between J. Edgar Hoover and his rival, Robert Kennedy, to create a top echelon informant program within the FBI. Robert Kennedy wanted to take down the mob. J. Edgar Hoover was reluctant at first to do it, but they created this program where they were going to use any methods necessary to turn gangsters against, you know, the bigger fish within the mob. And you had two rogue FBI agents, Dennis Condon and H. Paul Rico, the two men who ended up turning Whitey Bulger. Well, Barboza was the test case. They went after him first, and they said, Joe, what do you have to lose? These guys put you in prison. The only way you can get back at them is to testify in their trials. And he did. And over the course of several months, Joe Barboza is working with the FBI to create and to fabricate evidence that would put these guys at the scenes of these crimes. Mostly they're all bad guys, but they did not commit murders that Joe Barbosa said they did, and he testified against them. One of the most famous cases is the Edward Teddy Deegan case, which is known today as the Salvati case, mm-hmm. the Joe Salvati case. Joe Barbosa put Salvati and four other men in prison for 30 years for a crime they didn't commit, and that led to the biggest settlement against the U.S. Justice Department in history, about $102 million that was paid out just over a few years ago.
Now, according to your information, Barbosa, he testified in, what, three trials?
Three trials. One was the Deegan case, which we just talked about. He also testified against Raymond Patriarca, right. Sent him to prison for 5 to 7 years, mm-hmm. testified against Jerry Angiulo, who was acquitted for a murder that Barbosa tried to pin on him. And the federal government wanted to use Joe Barbosa to take down crime families all over America. So they couldn't put him in prison. They couldn't put him on the outside because he had a bounty on his head. That's why they created this witness protection program. But what they didn't understand is Joe Barbosa is a killer. That's what he does. So they create a program. They send him, his wife, and his child to Santa Rosa, California. Now, the only reason that Santa Rosa even rang a bell for me was because I'm a huge Hitchcock fan. And there's a movie called Shadow of a Doubt where Joseph Cotten comes into this town, a killer amongst people that don't know he's there, much like Joe Barbosa did for real life in the 60s.
And speaking of Hitchcock, are you going to make a cameo in this film like Hitchcock did in all his movies?
You get a chance to do that?
Well, who knows? You know, I mean, I'll ask the director if I can. You know, my kids want cameos in all the movies that that are going to be produced for my books.
Now, you said that Barbosa had two children. Are they still alive today?
Yes, they are. And in fact, one is a registered nurse on Cape Cod. Who, she was the first little girl ever put in the witness protection program. At 7 years old, she had to forget who she was to create this legend of this other person that she had claimed to be. And remember, she, her father, and her mother are out in California. Well, Joe Barbosa, he doesn't want to take that job that the U.S. Marshals Service had gotten for him. Joe Barbosa is a criminal. He's a killer. So he ends up killing a man in Santa Rosa several months after he gets there. And the Sonoma County Sheriff's Department has no idea how this dead body ended up in this desolate area in a shallow grave. Well, knock, knock, the FBI comes calling. They just want to help solve this crime. What they're doing is they're prohibiting the investigation. They knew it was Barbosa, but they didn't want Barbosa found out, so they were breaking into offices and hotel rooms of these sheriff's department deputies to try to burn and destroy evidence that would tie Barbosa to this crime.
Did they even testify? Weren't they part of a trial?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the shocking thing. Yeah, the prosecutors thought they had a layup. They thought they had Barbosa dead to rights because two of the women that actually helped Barbosa bury the victim's body, they found them, and the women were testifying against Barbosa. Well, again, in comes the FBI, not to testify for the prosecution, but to testify for the defense and to talk about what a great man Joe Barbosa was and how he helped bring the mafia down in New England. And, you know, this is 1971 now, and at that time the FBI was held in incredible high regard, especially among jurors, and the prosecutor knew he couldn't get the Capital One murder charge that he was looking for, so Barbosa struck a plea deal, pled guilty to second-degree murder, and served 5 years in prison before being let out again on the streets of San Francisco.
And he lived happily ever after?
Of course not. And that is the reason why I wrote the book. I wanted the story arc. I didn't want to glorify or glamorize the lives of these men. Joe Barbosa gets out in 1976 in San Francisco while the Boston Mafia has got a bounty on his head. They never forgot what he did to Joe Salvati and the rest of the men he put in prison. So Jerry Angiulo sent two hitmen to San Francisco. And they set Joe Barbosa up, and eventually, on a quiet day in San Francisco, a stolen van pulls around a corner where Joe Barbosa's standing trying to get in his car. The van slides open, two killers jump out with shotguns and end Joe Barbosa's life in very deadly fashion.
What's the difference between, in your opinion, you've covered them both, Whitey Bulger and Joe Barbosa?
There are a few differences. I think, you know, Whitey Bulger is the bookend to the Joe Barbosa story. It's not the other way around. Whitey Bulger came to power in the 1970s when everybody, all of the most dangerous gangsters in New England were gone. They were either killed or in prison because of the Irish mob war. So here's Whitey Bulger, who'd been in prison for the entire 1960s. He's got an open field. There really aren't any enemies out there or any people that would take him on at that time. So he really filled a void. But I think the core difference between Barboza and Bulger is the fact that Whitey Bulger, in his heart, was a killer of women. He showed a specialty in it. He enjoyed it. The victims, where he pulled their teeth out and where he strangled them, that's the kind of guy Whitey Bulger is. Joe Barboza was the opposite. He abhorred violence against women. Was he a psychopath? Yes. Did he kill men on a regular basis, 26 men? Absolutely. But if he saw anybody raise his voice to a woman, that man was going to get the beating of a lifetime.
I have to ask, we're kind of following along what's going on with the Bulger case. Bulger's trying to say that, he was kind of protected, so to speak, by the federal government. Do you feel that he might be trying to take a page out of Barboza's book, where maybe he was well versed as to what Barboza was tied into? And maybe
of course,
work this.
The same FBI agents who had turned Joe Barboza turned Whitey Bulger, and in fact, they did give him carte blanche to commit crimes and to commit murders. H. Paul Rico, one of the FBI investigators that really turned Bulger, he's complicit in many murders himself, including some of the murders where Joe Barboza was involved in the 1960s. I compare this now to what we'd been going through with the war on terror and how the CIA employed the tactics of the terrorists that they were looking to capture. And I think the FBI did the same thing in the 1960s, where eventually you could not tell the difference between the cops and the criminals.
And do you think this is something that may come out in this trial? I mean, if you can anticipate here, do you feel this is something that we may see in this trial, or do you feel that it might be something that the judge might kind of rein in and say, well, this is about this man?
I hope as a writer, it's all put on the table, because there's still information out there, especially in the Bulger case, that hasn't come to light yet. I know there are several books out there right now about Whitey Bulger, and they're all interesting in their own way, but there's still some information out there about Whitey Bulger that hasn't been told. And I think, the book Animal really tells, the whole story in its most complete form. People don't understand that, the mob was alive and well before Whitey Bulger came on the scene. Christine, about talking to these old gangsters, and I'd mentioned Whitey Bulger's name, and these guys were all survivors of the Irish mob war, and to a man, they all rolled their eyes. They all knew the myth of Whitey Bulger, but they also knew the reality of Whitey Bulger, and they felt Whitey Bulger would never have been as powerful as he was without his brother Billy in the state senate at the time. Without Billy, there wouldn't be a Whitey. Without Whitey, there would not be a Billy. So, it's great that the Bulger myth has been deconstructed in the past several months and almost a year since he's been captured. He's not that ghost that he once was.
I guess I would ask you is just talk about how tarnished you look at the FBI and what at one particular time how they were looked at. I mean, they had congressional hearings, and wasn't there a large settlement that was involved with their involvement with Barboza?
Oh, of course. It all came back to the Barboza case. And, as I said, $102 million was paid out to the families of the five men in the Teddy Deegan case. And the FBI's image has been tarnished. And
right. As
an agency. And, obviously there are bad apples in every bunch, but it was systematic. And that's what the Animal really talks about, and how, these guys weren't just creating, these playbooks and these game plans as they went along. They were being told and rewarded for the work that they were doing. J. Edgar Hoover himself knew that those five men that Barboza fingered for the Teddy Deegan hit did not do it. He knew it the day of the murder. Yet he was going to get those guys off the streets by any means necessary.
That's amazing. The more I hear you talk, the more I think, boy, what's the difference between some of the cops and some of the crooks? Turf wars, grudges, I'm going to get you. Kind of scary.
It's very scary. I mean, the fortunate thing is I've worked enough in my career with a lot of cops, and, 99% of them are incredibly heroic and fascinating, interesting people that have helped me in my own investigations. But that 1% is as deadly and dangerous as any mobster you'd ever run across.
Casey, after looking at the Animal and some of the other mobsters that you described in the Boston area, would you say that the Boston Mafia in many different forms is one of the most dangerous, if not the most dangerous, in the country?
I think it was at one particular time. Now, I don't think, you know, the Irish gangs are even powerful anymore. The Italians in the North End have been compartmentalized. You know, you always look at the next wave of gangster. You know, gangsterism in America, well, they started with the Jewish gangsters. Then, you know, the Jewish gangsters evolved into legitimate businessmen. Then the Irish, and then the Italians, and now you're getting the Mexicans and the Guatemalans. You had the Russians for a long time. And, you know, it's what group of people can be so violent and so dangerous that it's going to spread fear in an entire population. And those are the gangsters to worry about.
Have you had any threats when you put together this book?
I have not, thank God. You know, as I said, most of these people are, you know, older now, and, you know, they look back on the history of this case, which is what I wanted to do. And I think I'm very fair to just about everybody in the book, FBI, gangster alike. And I just tell the story the way it really happened. And, you know, I had to go through, you know, almost 10,000 classified and declassified documents, plus all the interviews that I did to get this book written. So, you know, everything is, you know, there's so much information in this story itself, but it, I think it reads well. It reads like a gripping novel, and that's what any book I write, I really want to think about the reader first and make sure I'm taking them on a journey, and they will see that journey with Animal.
How are they going to cast the movie? Any idea?
Well, you know, I think Javier Bardem would be a great Joe Barbosa.
Yes.
I mean, No Country for Old Men. I think he had three lines of dialogue, and he still won an Oscar for it. So I think he'd be great, but you never know. I mean, you know, the book has been optioned. We'll see if the movie's made. Fantastic. And, you know, I hope to just be in the audience eating popcorn and kind of watching these acts play out on film again.
We are speaking with Casey Sherman, who is the author of the book Animal: Bloody Rise and Fall of the Mob's Most Feared Assassin. What can this book
You can get it everywhere. I would go right to Amazon.com. You can download it on your Kindle tonight. You can pre-order it. It'll be in bookstores everywhere a week from today.
What are you hearing from folks, whether it's from your, from colleagues in the news, or maybe from folks who I've had a chance to read it, maybe the Globe, the New York Times. What are you hearing?
Terrence Winter, who is the creator of Boardwalk Empire and was a senior producer for The Sopranos, called it a classic. And, you know, that is one recommendation and one review that I would put above just any other right now, because here's a guy who knows what he's talking about. But it's been universally well praised so far, and I just want readers to enjoy it and, you know, get something out of it.
You know, it sounds like that just by listening to the conversation that we've had, that the movie could be one of the best Boston-based films, you know, we've seen yet. I mean, it really sounds like there'd be a lot of action, a lot of based on all true stuff.
Right. There are car bombings. I mean, imagine a gangster being kept on an island where the mafia hitmen are using speedboats to try to kill him. I mean, again, you can't make that stuff up. It really happened. I spent time on that island alone just to get a vibe of how long this man was out there with his family, and it was really an eerie place to be.
Do you have any last questions, Christine?
No, it's just I can't wait to read the book.
I can't wait.
But I'm only going to read it during daylight hours.
I would suggest that, yes.
Are you hoping that you'll be an advisor to this?
Yeah, that's already baked into the contract. And, you know, I'll just be, you know, any help that I can be on a film like that, I'd be happy to do that.
Casey, I got to thank you so much for joining us. Is there a website? Do you have a website?
Well, you know, people can reach me right on Facebook. I had a website for a long time, but I was always so far behind reaching back to people, and it was just because of my schedule. But now, if anybody wants to email me, find me on Facebook, shoot me a message, and I'd be happy to respond. And I'll be doing some book signings all over New England over the next month or so, and you can get that schedule on Facebook as well.
Excellent. Casey Sherman, we look forward to the book and the movie. Who knows, somewhere down the road, maybe the next couple of years.
Thank you.
We're going to step aside, and when we come back, we're going to talk casinos right here in southeastern Massachusetts. Don't go anywhere.